Hey, can you run the video for us? YouTube video? Yes, no. Yeah, almost. As soon as it starts, I'll get off the mic. Oop, I'll get off the mic. Wow, I sure do enjoy that. That is such. If you haven't seen the movie, it's Ushpizin. What happened? I don't know. If you haven't seen the movie, it's called Ushpizin. And if you like Adiran CDs, we simply got them at breslov.co.il that I put up there. Yeah, we went from the video to the browser. Okay, as usual, I want to welcome everybody for coming in. Let's see, everybody's here. Marvin Jackson. He looks new. MJS looks new. Omar, how are you? Twisted. Oh, nice crowd. Oopsie. I'll talk to him later. Anyway, are there any questions I can answer? Anything that had a difficult time with last week's Torah portion? Anything that we spoke about or didn't talk about? Should have. Now's the time. No questions? Well, I do wish I had video, but I just washed my payas, can't do a thing with them. And the computer where I usually have the video is doing whatever. So, bye, kid. It's my daughter. Oh, hey, if you want to put in a Ziploc the soup and the noodle salad, you're more than welcome. Okay, you want the noodle salad? It's up to you. Put in Ziploc. I'm sorry, I look the same. Okay, well, at 8 o'clock we're doing something different. Sorry, guys, it's I have a daughter over here, and we were talking, and she's leaving, so sorry, we have our day-to-day stuff going on. Okay, all right. Perfect. Look, that's what I look like. No, my wife's. Look, look, that's what I look like, right there. My wife says it looks just like me. What a hoot! Where'd you get those headphones? Well, those are cool. Okay, I'm more focused when the wifey is in here, so she's not. Well, she's not, but she's sitting right here. Say hello to everybody.
Hello, everybody. I'm sorry I'm late. It's my computer, so
I hope everybody heard that. What's going on with it? Now, what are they doing? It's something goofy. Okay. Sorry, you just barely heard her. She's doing some work on her laptop. That's her school computer, and that's the one with the camera. So she's doing some work on there. So I'm on my big old honking computer, and there is no camera on this. So I definitely do apologize. And next week, for those of you who are new in here, my name is Rabbi Davidzach, and welcome to the Noah chat on the virtual yeshiva. This is sponsored by the Oklahoma B'nai Noach Society, and the other person in black up there, Oki Noahide, kind of runs the show around here and runs me. And what I do is I teach out of a book called The Divine Code by Rabbi Moshe Weiner. And what this is the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which means it is the compendium of laws for B'nai Noach. The long Shulchan Aruch is not translated into English, but the Kitzur is available, and that's what I'm teaching from. You okay? Wow. You okay? Really? I'm sorry. Ooh, I saw the wifey get her little hackles up. That was kind of cool. So anyway, what I usually do is I do about 90 minutes out of the Divine Code, and we have a little discussion, and I watch the screen periodically, and if people come up with questions, which I hope you do, because a lot of the questions that we have, that I have fielded have been pretty good questions. And teaching as many years as I have been teaching, I have learned over the years that there's no such thing as a dumb question. The questions that you ask are usually a question that's on somebody else's mind, so as long as you're not too shy. Now, you can either send me a message in public, or you can go where it says all on your little screen, go all the way to the right, there's a drop-down arrow, and you can click on me, and you can send me a private message, and let me know if you want me to read it out loud or not. I won't mention your name if you don't want me to. Or you can just type in a question, and I will be more than happy to do my best at answering it. I have a lot of the answers, but I don't have all the answers. And the answers, if I don't have them, I would be very, 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 very pleased to go look it up. Larry would like to know the difference between the Kitzer and the other. Okay, the Shulchan Aruch, let me type this out. The Shulchan Aruch means a set table. That is a compendium of current law. And the Shulchan Aruch today is made up of a lot of different sections. Now, not everybody has the wherewithal or the time to read the entire Shulchan Aruch. It's volume after volume after volume. And as an example, I'm studying Choshen Mishpat, which is two volumes out of the Shulchan Aruch in Hebrew. And we're about, I don't know, 12 pages into it. We've been working on it for a few months. So instead of that, what they do is they take the most important part of it, and in other words, all the laws of the seven are discussed in the Kitzer. But what it is it gives you the, as people say, what do I need to know and how do I need to do it? And that's what the Kitzer does. It's Kitzer. Yes. Yes. So the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch is kind of the, it's the one for, as an example in Jewish thought, if I want to go find out an answer to a question and I want all the details, I can go to the Gemara, I can go to the Shulchan Aruch, I can look them up. I can go to the Mishnah Berurah, I can look them up. But if I just want to know the down and dirty quick version of it, I'll go to the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch, look it up, and I'll have the answer in no time at all. So it's a much easier, a much clearer version. It's kind of like the condensed version, but it's all the stuff you need to know. In other words, when I started studying about 25 years ago, the first set of law that I had was the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch, which in the English and the Hebrew version of it's five volumes. I have it in one volume in the Hebrew, and you can now get them in two volumes. So rather than this whole huge thing that I have, it was condensed down. And that's what we're doing. We're doing the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch called the Divine Code. And this is what we're going to be doing. Any other questions? Wow, look at all these people in here. How cool is that? And please, I do like an interactive class. And if you do have a question, please send it to Oki, send it to Larry. If he's in here, Larry's not in here. And I'll be more than happy to answer it. Okay. We are in a, this is like really neat. We're in a new section. We're on page 257. Not a real long section. Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's only a little 30 pages, I suppose, just under 30 pages. Aw, bummer. Yeah, Refuah Shleima for your computer. Okay, this is part 3, the prohibition of blasphemy. And this is including the laws of vows. And so one thing that's kind of important to understand that you'll see me type, if I send you an email or I send you a note back or something, and I type either this or this, I'm saying blenator. Blenator is without a nader, and nader is a vowel. Have you ever heard of the song called Kol Nidre? All naders, all vowels. Kol Nidre. We did that in for Yom Kippur. So I say things, I'll be at your house at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, blenator. And that is without a vowel, because one thing that you'll notice if you have, yeah, without a vowel, if you notice in Torah that a person who vows a vowel and does not do what that person said they would do, they quote-unquote swear on something, that is a very, very serious crime. You have to be very, very careful. If two people find a garment, this is in Bava Metzia, in the Gemara. If two people find a garment, and one person reaches over and picks it up, they go in front of a Jewish court and they say, this one says it's mine and that one says it's mine, they have to both swear that it's theirs. It's a lot more complicated than this, and the judge makes a ruling on it. So it is very important. If you make a vow and you're lying, that can be very, very, very serious. And so if you're going to make somebody a promise, I would really strongly consider what you're promising. And there's some people that have a huge difficulty, which I'm surprised I don't have a question on this one. There are people out there that have a huge difficulty with somebody being quote-unquote wishy-washy. I'll be at your house about 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'll do the best I can, and hopefully I'll see you. That sounds very non-committal, and some people do get a little bit offended at that. But in the world, in the circle of people that I run in, blenator, I mean, I study. I do most of my heavy-duty studying on Sunday. That's when I have all my study buddies. And I know pretty much we're going to talk each week. I get about 6 hours of study buddies. And I'll say, hey, I'll talk to you next week, blenator. I'll be available at 6 o'clock in the evening, blenator. Okay? We say, Hashem willing, yeah, God willing. That is appropriate, Oki, but if you're going to tell somebody that you're definitely going to do something, that's when you would say blenator, or without a nader, without a vowel. Okay, everybody got that? So, the obligation, and in here it is, there's four areas, the obligation to respect God's name and what is forbidden as blasphemy. Obligation to revere and fear God. Now, here's another one we've spoken about before, but seeing how there are some new peoples in here, new people in here, there are two, what's a good word I'm looking for? Aspects of loving God. There's love and fear. Now, every time I bring this up, people just kind of go, they kind of jump up and run around like Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone. Loving God is an absolute, without any reservation, love of our Creator. Fear of God is not that cowering in the corner, which, you know, here's what I would make kind of a, if I had the video, you'd see me going, it is not a cowering in the corner fear of God. It is a fear of not wanting to disappoint your divine parent. Now, most of us growing up, and if you sit back and you think about a second, and all of a sudden a picture comes to mind of that disappointed look on mom or dad's face when you have done something wrong, like the project that's due tomorrow in school. You just told mom about it at 6 o'clock on a Sunday evening, and all the stores are closed, and you can't have it done for tomorrow, that look of, it's almost, it's of extreme disappointment. You not wanting to see that look on a parent's face is, in essence, in English, a fear. So we have a love of our Creator, and we have a fear, not a fear of cowering in the corner, a bolt of lightning is going to come through the ceiling and cook us to a crispy critter. It is a fear of not wanting to disappoint our divine parent from doing something questionable or flat out wrong. Okay? Laws of vows and promises, annulments of vows and promises, and vows made according to the public's understanding are the four general areas we're going to cover in the prohibition of blasphemy. Ooh. Again, I would... Okay, I'm going to start off with the introduction. I would strongly recommend that you get hold of this book because there are... The beautiful thing about getting a Jewish book or a book written by Jews like this Rabbi Moshe Weiner, whenever you buy a book, I'm sure a lot of you have taken, if you've got the Stone Edition Chumash, this is an exact example. If you open to any page in the Chumash, on the right-hand side, you got the Hebrew at the top and the little column on the side beside the Hebrew is Onkelos. Then there's a line, then there's commentaries. On the left-hand side, you have the English, a line, then commentaries. So everything is footnoted and explained to some degree depending on who the commentator is. As an example, we're going to be talking about the Torah portion called Chukas today in a little while. And that one section that is probably one of the most confusing aspects of this Torah portion is a little thing about the red heifer. And we'll be going into a little bit of detail on that later. But I have the Midrash Says, Midrash Tanhuma, the Gutnik, I have the Stone, I have the Ramban, and I have Elucidated Rashi, Midrash Tanhuma, and two other ones. And so these are the commentaries that I could read about this particular rite, if you will, lack of a better term in English, of the red heifer. And this is the nice thing about this book, The Divine Code, is up above you'll have a discussion of the law. Below you have the footnotes to explain where they got the information in case you want to do any further research. And that's the cool thing about a book like this. And you don't find that in other books. In fact, that's what I do when I look for a book. If I'm going to a bookstore and looking for a book, the first thing I'll do is I'll take a look in the back. I'll take a look and see if there's any footnotes, etc., because if somebody's going to write a book and if it's important for me to have on my bookshelf, I want to make sure that the person who has written that has appropriate sources, because it's very important, because everything that I tell you, everything that I teach you, everything that I teach here in the town I live in is not Torah according to me. It's not Torah according to Rabbi Dov, because mine's greater than I have put things down on pieces of paper, and this is what I study, and this is what I teach. Okay, everybody out there? Well, we've got some more people coming in. How cool is that? Okay. At the very center of the world is our Homo sapiens, the human being divinely endowed with intellect. This intellect, this is the introduction again on the section on the prohibition of blasphemy. This intellect allows us analytical thought and examination of ourselves and the world around us. Without divinely endowed criteria for truth and moral values, however, our critical thinking is abstract and theoretical at best and obviously susceptible to error. And that's a huge one. That is a huge one. It's, again, not the world according to an individual. And those people out there who teach that it's Torah or it's a Bible according to, hey, Devorah, according to me, is a huge problem in my opinion. Thus God revealed to mankind knowledge of his inscrutable will by means of his prophets and the Torah to know what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil. The divine revelation of the Torah at Mount Sinai and the divine designation of Moses as the foremost prophet for all time set forth the ultimate test for the truth of future prophets, that is to say, compatibility with the Torah and its eternal commandments. Even so, this legal and moral code is meaningful only when applying the other special gift endowed upon humans, namely freedom of choice to follow or reject proper conduct. Oh, sorry, Devorala, the cam is on my wife's computer and her computer. She's in the process of talking to tech support to get that all figured out. It's still me. but I'm having a bad payus day. Oh, those of you that are new in here, if you're not going to have fun in this class, you can't have fun. And not my fault. I do have a sense of humor, and I don't pick on many people. And when I do pick on somebody, I warn them ahead of time. Yeah, me too. I learn better when I see me too. Yeah. God willing, and the creek don't rise next week. Okay. Open-minded and consistent reasoning readily leads to a realization that there must be a supreme cause for our most complex yet intricately precise world. Thus we arrive at the recognition and acknowledgement of God as creator, sovereign, and sustainer of the universe. This acknowledgement is not only an intellectual conclusion, but of itself has practical implications. Oh, cool. That's good. Recommended reading. Oh, yeah, I usually do this best on cam. For those of you that are new in here, I know there are other organizations and other groups of people out there that want you to go buy $10,000 worth of books. I'm exaggerating, but there are other groups that say you need this and this and this and this. I'm asking the people in this room who truly want to study and get to really the basics of what you have to know and grow from there is to start off with 3 books for 2 years. That's it. 3 books for 2 years, and if you catch the right sale, it'll cost you under $100. In fact, well under $100. The Stone Edition Chumash, which is the 5 books of Moses, and you can pick that up online at Eichler's. Amazon's having a sale. I mean, not Amazon. Art Scroll's having a sale now, etc. Anywhere from $35 to $45 for a good Torah with commentaries. The Divine Code is what I am reading from. I think that's $18, and the Prayer Book. That's it. Anything other than that, if you choose to get it, it's up to you, but it's not essential. I know, like I said, there's a lot of organizations out there and a lot of things that I have been involved with in the past that say, well, you need to go out and buy this, and let me put my website up so you can buy it from me. I don't sell books. I don't sell CDs. I don't sell tapes. All I can do is suggest where to get these things, and it's up to you if you get it or not. And that's kind of about as blunt and as simple and to the point as I can get. Yeah, the Stone Edition has good commentaries. There's other ones, but I get those in 5-volume sets because they're just very, very... Yeah. Yeah, that's true. The Divine Code is wonderful. Anyway, okay, let me keep going. Noting that life, health, and all human needs and blessings emanate unceasingly from the Creator, we must surely acknowledge this in thought, speech, and action. We ought to express gratitude for the divine benevolence on which we are continuously dependent and make ourselves into worthy recipients thereof. This is the concept of worshiping God that applies equally to all Jews and all Gentiles alike. I hope everybody heard that. One more time. This is the concept of worshiping God that applies equally to all Jews and Gentiles alike. And I want to make something very, 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 very clear. In order for you to get a fast pass, I don't know if you've ever been to a Six Flags or a Disneyland or anything like that, but if you have, there's something called a fast pass, which if you have one of those and it's your time, so to speak, you go to the head of the line and you go in. A Jew is responsible for 626 laws, 613 in Torah, 7 rabbinical enactments, and 6 constant mitzvahs. Comes to 626 plus some of the other things that we have to do. That's our path of doing mitzvahs to get us into heaven. The wonderful people in this room, now everybody listen very carefully to this because I've said it before and I'll say it almost every single time I'm in this class because it's very important to understand. You have 7 mitzvahs, 7 laws. And the amazing thing about this, and a lot of people don't get this right away, is there are 6 laws that simply say, don't do these. And 1 that says, do this. So with 6 laws that God says don't do, and you simply abstain from doing those, And you have the opportunity to do the other law, which is a positive commandment. There's your fast pass. That's amazing. That is just amazing. There's other faiths out there in the world who are going to give you line after line, do this, you're this, you're that, you'll never get here, you'll never get there, you're going to fry forever. No. That's not what this is all about. This isn't that way. These seven laws that I've been going over here for several months now, there's simply six that say don't and one that says do. And that's all you have to do. Technically, you don't have to do anything else. And I find that just remarkable, and that gets you, that will get you a place to live with us when Moshiach arrives, or may he be revealed in our time. You guys are going to be living with us. That's what it talks about in Torah, the strangers among us. That's you guys. And that's the reason why I'm doing this class. I think it's just marvelous. Plus, I'm a pretty good cook. I do a pretty mean barbecue. I also cook. Anything above the seven is strictly by choice and then must be done in a rabbinical supervision? Yes. Where is what found in Torah? Oh, Omar, if you go to into the Stone Edition Chumash and you go to the glossary in the back, it is in, it's talking about the stranger that lives among us. Omar, when the Mashiach arrives, where are all Jews going to end up? This is a very simple answer. Where are all Jews going to end up? Israel. Now, in Torah, it discusses the strangers that live with us, right? These are people who have chosen not to be Jews. And you don't have to be like me. Don't go through conversion to be like me. It's too hard to be like me. And so those people who choose not to take on the entire yoke of Torah, take on the yoke of the seven laws. That's the strangers that live among us. Hang on one second. I got a PM here. Okay. So the bottom line, Omar, when Mashiach arrives, we'll be in Israel. The righteous Gentiles will be living us and living with us, and everybody else is get to go through what they have to go through, and it ain't going to be pretty. Okay. All right, the diametric opposite of this ideal of reverence for God and the crass and sinful conduct of deprecating God and his sovereignty, this is referred to as blasphemy. It's an interesting word. In common usage, the word blasphemy is generally defined as any form of uttered impiety, irreverence, or sacrilege against God, God forbid. These are acts of defiance seeking to impair the appropriate aspect and reverence for God. That's heavy-duty stuff. In the Torah, the sin of blasphemy is circumscribed in terms of cursing God, God forbid. In this religious context, blasphemy is regarded as so unimaginable a rebellion and offensiveness that the traditional Hebrew terminology for it is Birkat Hashem. The euphemism Birkat Hashem literally means this means blessing the name. That is God. Thus, the very opposite of what is used to signify, the Torah has two explicit references to this offense. Exodus 22:27 states, "You shall not curse God." Chas v'shalom. The Hebrew word here is tekelel, and the root word kal means to degrade or hold in low esteem or despise, chas v'shalom. God forbid. Ooh, can't even imagine that. Leviticus 24:10 relates the incident of one who violated the cited injunction of Exodus 22:27 and the divine edict declaring this to be a capital sin. Furthermore, it states here, Ish, any man who curses his God shall bear his sin. Why the double expression of Ish, literally a man, to include all mankind, both Jews and Gentiles in this? Wow. Blasphemy, thus, is prohibited to Gentiles as a capital sin as it is for Israelites. So it is a capital sin. Wow. This reiterates the earlier prohibition of the Noahide Code expressed in an all-inclusive verse in Genesis 2:16, in Hashem, the Yud in the Hay and the Vav in the Hay, God commanded. The citation of the Tetragrammaton name in this verse alludes to the prohibition of blasphemy to Gentiles. So, I can't do it. You're not allowed to do it. Oh, Devorah, good night, good night, good night. Thank you for coming in. Be well. Say hi to Gabe. A Gentile would be guilty of this offense when uttering a blasphemous statement that invokes any of the explicit divine names in Torah's Hebrew text, which are those which are forbidden to be erased when spelled out in full, as in chapter 1 below, for the word Adoshem, Elohim, and Yah, etc. The Tetragrammaton itself. Or any appellation clearly referring to God, that is to say the Supreme Being, the Almighty, the Creator, the One Above, etc. Or attribute names, that is to say terms distinctly referring to the divine attributes and identified with God, in whatever language it might be. Wow. That's pretty clear. Okay. Almost done, then we'll get into chapter 1. This again is the introduction. I'm on page 260. You have to get the book if you don't have it. It's really wonderful. Okay. Conceptually, blasphemy is closely linked to heresy and idolatry. Like the other Noahide commandments, however, it is really a comprehensive category which subdivides into a number of bylaws. By definition, it involves not only a generic prohibition, but of itself implies a number of obligations. An early authority thus notes, do not err about a well-known enumeration of the seven precepts of the children of Noah, as cited in the Talmud. In truth, these seven are like seven comprehensive principles, which contain numerous particulars. The very idea of there being a divinely ordered Noahide code presupposes an acknowledgement of A, the existence of God, B, the authority of God as supreme being, C, the reality of the divine revelation instructing mankind with regards to proper conduct, D, the principle of divine retribution, that is to say that man is accountable for obeying or disobeying these instructions because the legal code devoid of consequences is ineffective. Very important. Let me say that one more time. A legal code devoid of consequences is ineffective. So therefore, the six don't do and the one do are a set of laws to live by. And at this point, if it is a legal code and there are consequences, as Noahides, like it is for a Jew, that if you violate them, there are certain consequences. More specifically, the Noahide prohibition of blasphemy derives from an acceptance of the supremacy of a sovereign, the sovereignty of God, which is ipso facto demands respect or appropriate reverence for God. It follows then that, and this is the following, all Gentiles are subject to the precept of awe and reverence before God, more commonly referred to as the fear of God. Sefer HaChinuch states clearly this precept applies everywhere at all times and to the whole human species. This is one of the constant ones, is a belief in God. Jews just simply, you believe in God, period. This is something that I find amazing in both Jews and Gentiles. I've talked to people who don't believe in God. I'm flabbergasted. And the reason is I've asked these people, they says, oh, this whole thing was a big mistake. It was just a convergence of things that started this planet that we call Earth. And I look at these same people and I says, you know something? A candle can't light itself. Something has to start. Something started this. I believe it does. And my wife read something this last weekend, and when she gets done doing what she's doing with her computer, perhaps I'll get her to cite her source, that Jerusalem is the navel of the earth, and from that area is where the Big Bang started. Think about that for a while. I thought that was pretty profound. Now, what is the starting point of the Big Bang that started this entire thing called creation that went for 6 days? Where did it start? Yeah. You know where the Holy of Holies is? That's an interesting thought. Okay. Ooh, a lot of chatter going on out there. Number two. Ooh, I'll get to the meat of this in just a minute. Anyone here seen an accident? How come something so incredibly beautiful and well designed has started accidentally? Yeah. Very good. Actually, this is interesting. Aha, you got me off on a tangent. Toria, is it Toria? Toria? Is that, I don't know how to pronounce your name. Is it Toria? Toria? Troia. Troia. Oh, what a pretty name. Okay, think about this. Look what she wrote. Now listen, everybody listen. Troia said, oh, rats. Listen, Big Bang Theory. God spoke it and bang, it happened. Here's an interesting little aside. Troia, consider this. Humans, when a human being wants to tell somebody something or to say something or to even have a thought, that starts in the subconscious. Right, Troia? Right, Troia? Ooh, there's mom and daughter. How cool is that? Okay. Toria. 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 Ooh, I like that. Okay, anyway, Toria, I think I got it right that time. Here, this is kind of cool, listen. When a human being wants to say something, a human being will, the thought starts in the human subconscious. And that subconscious thought eventually becomes a conscious thought, and we will act on it or not act on it, depending. If you want to know to what level God understands the human being, he understands us on the subconscious level. Because that is really something that we really have no control over. Okay? Now, bring that forward. When God's created, when God decided he's going to create this physical existence, it didn't happen when the divine said it. Because even the divine mind, which is too amazing for a mere human being to understand, when a thought starts in the divine subconscious, whatever that looks like, and there's no discussion on what that looks like, when a thought starts in the divine subconscious, that's when this Big Bang actually started. So everything was created with a thought, and the utterances were to describe the action that happened subconsciously. So I thought that hopefully that was that was clear. It didn't go over too many people's heads. Okay, let's keep moving on. A Gentile is not to use God's name in vain, period. To use God's name in vain. A Torah prohibition stated explicitly for Jews in the third of the Ten Commandments is closely allied with the principle of blasphemy. It is clearly a form of disrespect. This would then also include a prohibition to swear falsely. Thus, we find in the Torah that from the earliest times, the concept of an oath was regarded as a sacred obligation by Gentiles as well. Yeah, I'm at the top of page 261, number 3. It says the sin of blasphemy will never be forgiven. So basically, God thought it's God's subconscious thought. Then it happened. Then once it went from a God's subconscious thought, it went into God's conscious thought, and then the utterances. So there's something that will kind of give you food for thought for the rest of the week. Okay. Yeah, I thought so. 3. A Gentile must likewise respect God's creatures, and thus one is not to curse or harm humans, for they are created by God in his image and likeness, as it were. The image of God within mankind is not the form of the human body, God forbid, which would be a false and idolatrous concept, but rather the unique capacity for intellect and speech that is possessed by the human and living soul, and its ability to distinguish between good and evil. Wow, that's a big one. God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Genesis 1:27. This is reiterated in the Noahide code in the context of the prohibition of murder. Whosoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God he made man, Genesis 9:6. Thus it is also said of the Torah's golden rule to love your fellow as yourself, Leviticus 19:18. Holiness code. God is not man. Yeah. Not sure what that means. Rabbi Akiva once said, love your fellow as yourself. This is the main principle of the Torah. But as I responded, quoting Genesis 5:1, this is the book of the descendants of Adam. In the day he created man, he made him in the likeness of God. This is an even greater principle. Thus, if you put another human being to shame, no one realizes who you put to shame for. He made him in the image of God. That's a biggie. Oh, yeah. Omar, there is a difference between killing and murder. Okay, Omar? In war, a soldier has to kill. That's Torah. A soldier has to kill. But lying in wait of somebody, jumping out from behind a tree or whatever, jumping out of a tree or whatever you do, and taking somebody's life in a premeditated state and on the sly, that's a sin. There is a difference between killing and murder. Okay? All right. I'm on page 262. How am I doing on time? Good. I'm on page 262. This is chapter 1 of the section called The Prohibition of Blasphemy. The obligation to respect God's name, and what is forbidden as blasphemy. Yeah, true. Before I keep going, are there any questions? Now is the time to ask. I got mom and daughter in here. How cool is that? Okay. No questions? That's not a bad thing. But I like questions. All right, number 1. Gentiles are warned against blessing God's name. The term is euphemistic and means cursing God's name. Hi, Chesed, 7-year-old granddaughter. Hey, Jacob 40, nice. Adam, the first person, was warned about this as it says, and this is Genesis 2:16, and the Lord commanded upon Adam. This means that God commanded his divinity and authority upon Adam. The three meanings of this statement are as follows. Hey, welcome back. I am God, do not exchange me for another god, small g, this being the prohibition of idolatry. I am God, do not curse me, capital me, this being the prohibition of blasphemy, chas v'shalom. I am God, the fear of me shall be upon you, this being the obligation to fear God. Fearing God is a part of the general commandment to guard oneself against committing blasphemy. In Tractate Sanhedrin 56b, although the Talmud states, my fear shall be upon you, this is a commandment to establish courts of law. It is obvious that this explanation does not change the simple meaning of the commandment. On the contrary, the main intent of my fear is that one should have fear of heaven, that is to say, fear of God. This obligation to fear him is further understood to teach about the obligation to fear the courts. Which is, let's see, do I want to go off on this tangent? Sure. I'm involved in a study of something called Choshen Mishpat. Choshen Mishpat, a choshen is, you know, the breastplate that the priest wore that kind of lit up the Urim and Thummim and were on his shoulders, and he had the breastplate in front of him that lit up. That is the choshen. What the choshen did is when a question was asked, depending on how things lit up the order and how it's interpreted, we understood what we're supposed to do or not do. And that's very complicated, but that's in short what it is. Now, Choshen Mishpat is a section of the Shulchan Aruch that I have been studying. Nice. And it's a fascinating, fascinating, fascinating set of laws. And one thing that we've been discussing on and off for the last 3 weeks is as follows. When the Mashiach arrives, and may he arrive in our time, there will be courts set up in Israel. Okay? Righteous Gentiles will have courts, Jews will have courts, you can come to our courts, etc. It'll be a set up court system with a Sanhedrin at the top, down to a small Sanhedrin, to smaller courts of 5, 3, etc. And these will adjudicate various things. There's 5 things that it'll take care of. So anyway, today we have Jewish courts out there in the world. And Jewish courts should be a court that a Jew, if he has to take another Jew to get something, a wrong set right, or to have something straightened out. That is a mitzvah to do. For two people to come in to select the judges for the court to hear the case and to adjudicate the case, and for the people to abide by the finding of the Beis Din is a huge mitzvah. It is a wonderful, wonderful good deed. But here's the sin and here's the problem. The sin and the problem is as follows. People will start off at a Beis Din, not like what happened, and run off to the secular court. That's a sin. Or go to the secular court to have something adjudicated and not go through a Beis Din. Yes. Hey, what happened? What's going on? Why? Well, we got the extended warranty. Oh, whew. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that is a huge, huge, huge problem. And the guy I've been studying this with, and he and I have gone back and forth, and, you know, the idea that it's a mitzvah going in front of a Beis Din, having something adjudicated, and trusting the judges who are learned men to adjudicate something is a mitzvah. But taking somebody to the secular court, very bad. That is a huge chilul Hashem. That's a very, very bad thing. Still on with him? I thought we had the extended warranty on that dude. So it's the operating system then. I'll just take it to Einstein and send him a bill. I'll take it tomorrow. Okay. Worry about it. Okay. It will all over the gentleness, yeah. Because a secular court doesn't follow Torah for its judgments. No, the computer, that's another story. Because a secular court doesn't follow Torah for its judgments. What's interesting is a lot of secular laws out there in the world are based on Torah law, but the problem is how things are adjudicated and how things are handed down are very different. Very different. Okay, any other questions? All right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, to be a judge in a Jewish court in a Beis Din, I have a lot of respect for those people. In fact, the one I know in Los Angeles, Rabbi Cohen, is a remarkable man. He really is. He's a very remarkable man. Very, very well respected on this half of the world. Yeah, okay. I am God, the fear of me shall be upon you, etc. Okay, this prohibition was again commanded explicitly in the Torah regarding Gentiles, as it says, any man who will blaspheme his God shall bear his sin, and one who pronounces blasphemously God's name shall be put to death by a court. Did you say that Beis Din should be the courts for righteous Gentiles? That's what we're talking about, setting up courts of law for righteous Gentiles. Chesed, that is one of the seven laws. You're to establish courts of law, and your courts of law are what you're supposed to set up. Yes. But the idea, Chesed, is let's suppose that Chesed and Oki have a disagreement, and they were to go to Francis for adjudication of a disagreement. As long as Oki and Chesed agree to Francis adjudicating the case and abide by the decision, that's what you're supposed to do. Okay? Now you can't bribe her with flowers. Nice try. Okay, is that clear? Does that make sense? That's this whole thing of setting up courts. Okay? Of course they can be, but Chesed, don't forget Chesed. The law of setting up courts of justice is one of the seven. Hey, Brian, thanks for coming in. No, not necessarily, Oki. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Listen. It says that you, righteous Gentiles, are to set up courts of justice. Okay? Everybody see the whiteboard? Everybody see the whiteboard? How do I get my pointer on there? I'm going to take the laser. Okay? Right here, number 7. Take a look-see. See number 7? The commandment to establish laws and courts of justice. That doesn't say that you're setting up courts of justice to answer to me. if Oki and Chesed have a disagreement, and Oki and Chesed ask Francis to adjudicate it, okay? Then that's how it works. Where do the laws part come in? The laws are the seven. And of course we know from reading this book, The Divine Code, that each one of those are broken out. And we're talking about blasphemy. Blasphemy isn't up there, yet cursing God's name is one of the seven. And what they're doing is they're taking those and breaking them down. Yes. But that's why you folks are studying. I venture to guess that the people who come into this room, who have studied, understand that there is a prohibition against worshiping false gods. And if there's a prohibition against worshiping false gods, and you see somebody out there who's violating that, and there are two witnesses, that person gets schlepped in front of a Beis Din. If you're out there and you witness somebody bumping somebody off, you take them to a Beis Din. Can you establish laws that have already been established? Give me an example. I don't understand your question. How can you establish a law that's already been established? I'm not sure what you mean. Yes, no, yeah. You guys got to work on your typing speed. I.e., the first six and their supplemental laws. I still don't understand your question. The first six are the first six. There are six prohibitions. Prohibition against worshiping false gods. Idolatry, blasphemy, murder, sexual relations that are forbidden, theft, eating the flesh of a living animal. Those six are very clear, and that's not establishing other ones. Again, Chesed, if you take as an example, cursing God's name. Cursing God's name, I went over in the introduction to this, and in the introduction it says, and there are four sub-areas. The four sub-areas are the obligation to respect God's name, which the opposite of that is blasphemy, obligation to revere and fear God, laws of vows and promises, and four, the annulment of vows, promises, and vows made according to the public understanding. These are the subsets of blasphemy. Now, under each one of these, this book, The Divine Code, breaks those down. Now, it's courts of justice. You can't establish laws. Yeah. Okay? All right. Got it? Yes, no, maybe so. Okay. Thus Moses received, transmitted it. Okay. With the definition of pronounces blasphemously God's name in the above cited verse, which refers to the explicit name of God. The explicit name of God is either the tetragrammaton, which is the yud in the hay and the vav in the hay. Please define a Beis Din. A Beis Din is a religious court, a house of judgment. So here's what you have to do with the establishing. It's not necessarily establishing laws, it's establishing courts of justice, because the laws are the seven laws. Those are the laws. I mean, that's what they are. But courts of justice to adjudicate based on that law is what it is. Okay? Got that? Yes? No? Yeah, it's probably... Yeah. Well, Chesed, you might want to talk to Oki about the wording of those, because I didn't write it. True. A lot of the laws are based for somebody's benefit. And that's going to be the beauty of the time when Mashiach arrives. Okay. That's fine. V. Gates. Okay, hang on a second, one and all. Play on words should be noted. Okay. What page, Pam? True Chesed 27. Okay. Okay. The capital sin, this is interesting. I'm on page 263 in this book. The capital, my little cursor went away. There we go. Okay. The capital sin of blasphemy is committed if a person clearly requests with his mouth a curse from God upon the explicit name Gevalt. How? By invoking one of the holy names of God or one of his attributive names against the explicit name. That is to say that God, as he is called by one of his names, should do such and such to harm to himself. And he is called by the explicit name. Wow. I can't even imagine someone doing that, but that's what blasphemy is. Okay. It says in here, if you use one of God's explicit names. Now, we all know what this one is, right? Oops, how'd I get it over there? That was weird. Okay, that's one of God's names. The Yud Heh and the Vav Heh, okay, that is called the Tetragrammaton. There's another one, Adoshem, Elohim. That's one of God's specific names, okay? Now, taking one of those specific names of God, and the way you would commit blasphemy, God forbid, is if a person clearly requests with his mouth, it has to be spoken with the mouth, a curse from God upon the explicit name. So if you say something, God forbid, that may Elohim curse such and such, that is blasphemy. That's absolute blasphemy. Okay? So you're asking a name of God to curse God upon one of his explicit names. That's a bad thing. That's just crazy. Okay, topic three below. Okay. One is liable if this stated in a way, may Yossi strike Yossi. Okay? No. It's not a curse of person. It's cursing God. It's like saying, may Omar strike Omar. Okay? So you're using a name of God to do something against another name of God. Okay? You got that? Okay? Using the euphemistic name Yossi does not carry any liability. So it would be stupid, but you know something? Okay, people do that. It's insane. People do that. If you get somebody who has issues, quote-unquote issues with God, and there are people out there that are mad at God. I don't understand that. I have seen it. And I know people who have gotten very... Bill Maher, I don't know. I don't listen to him. It is too weird, but you know something? There are people who do that, if you think about it. You might know people, if you think about it, that there are people out there that something happens in their life and they turn around and blame God for doing something bad to them. And they turn around and they curse God. That's not the same, Paul, because what you're doing is the second word in that is not one of God's names. Okay? Got that? It is a good question. It is a very good question. But there are people out in the world who have something's happened to them, to their family, or to a loved one. I'm going to put it in your little briefcase and I'll take it with me tomorrow. Okay. Okay. Hang on a second, one and all. Okay. Gabriella is here. Hey. Okay. Let's go back into this. Oh, I need you to see something on here. This I got from here. That's from her. Okay. That's her name. I'll leave it up here till you have a chance to write it down. Okay, sorry about that, guys. A little bit of family business here. All right. Wow, this is where it gets complicated. Okay, follow this. If you pronounce it with a J to start, you didn't pronounce it right anyway. Oh, that one. But that's not. But that's not a curse the way it's said. Okay? What word is that? Twisted. There's no W in Hebrew. There's no W in Hebrew. And that's not a Torah name for God. Twisted. That's not a Torah name for God. Okay, twisted. Here's what you're looking for. Okay? Okay? That is the four-letter name of God that some people call that other thing that you wrote. Okay? Whew. Not a problem. And the way you would say that four-letter name of God would be, when I refer to it, I would say Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. Nobody knows how it's pronounced today, Oki. Nobody has any idea how it's pronounced. That is the name that was lost when the temple was destroyed. The gates. What's it doing on there? Me too. Well, check and see. Blow what you got to blow away. Yeah, nobody knows how to pronounce that today. And if you notice, when I say one of these names of God, I type it Elohim. That way I won't be using God's name in vain, okay? Elohim, then instead of... There's Adoshem, etc. Okay? Omar, let's see. Rabbi, is it wrong to say GM? I don't know what that word is. Split it up with spaces between it, please. I don't know what that word means. yeah. Any kind of curse like that, I wouldn't, it's not considered blasphemy, it's just foul mouth. That's one that I know a lot of people, and I go out and play golf, I hear that a lot. And anybody who is a, yeah, I wouldn't use it because it's just, that's just, yeah, twisted, very good. Okay, every single time, Yeah. Twist it here. Every single time there is a name of God mentioned in Torah, it's a different attribute of God. Okay? As an example, Twisted, this is a wonderful question. As an example, if you open your Stone Edition, Edition Chumash, and you look at creation, take a look at creation. It starts off with Breshit Bra Elokim et Hashemayim et Haaretz, okay? That Elokim, that Kel Lohi and Yud Mem ending is, oops, I didn't spell it right, thank God. This is hard to do without messing up. I got to put spaces in there. That is an attribute of God that consists of God and, oopsie, Lohi, which is the heavenly court. When God created this physical world, he created a sense of justice, under strict judgment, justice. So when God created, the witnesses were creation was the heavenly court. You've heard that term, heavenly court, and that's what it means. Now, if you go further, as you go through in the Stone Edition, it will go Elohim, then it will have Havaya, then eventually this. And if you take a look at what happened, you have the Elohim, then Elohim Havaya, then Elohim Havaya, then you have Havaya Elohim, then just Havaya. What happened there? You have to take a look at creation and how God's name is put in there. In English, and this is one of the problems with a Bible from one of the other stores, so to speak, like the King James or NIV or one of these other ones, is there's only two names, and this is getting back to Twisted's question, there are only two names for God in English, and they're both very lacking in what they mean, and that's Lord and God. In Hebrew, 70 different attributes and aspects. This is even a name of God. That's a name of God. When you're saying shalom to somebody, you're saying, oopsie, home row. Hello, goodbye, or peace. Okay? Seeing how we are made in God's image, saying hello, you're acknowledging that in your fellow man, that's one of God's name. Hashem, these are great questions. Hashem is the Yud K Vav K. That's what it is. That's the name. When it says Hashem, that's the Yud K Vav K. Okay? The four-letter name, the Tetragrammaton, that's the name. There's Shekai. That's another name of God. That's the one that you see on the mezuzah, on the door, that the shin, that's one of the names. Great questions. So when do I say Hashem and when God? Just call him Hashem. But Rabbi, aren't the titles like I'm a father, son, brother, but my name is Omar? No, yeah, your father, a son, a brother, yes, but you're talking more like, you know the term, I'm wearing a different hat today, Omar? I'm wearing my accounting hat. I'm wearing my father with, you know, my fist going against my palm because you've taken my car and come home 2 hours late. You know, go to your room, you're grounded. These are different attributes of ourselves. We're a cheerful dad. We're a bad dad. We're a mad dad. We're all of these different things. These are different attributes of the same person. In other words, it's not that I am father, son, and brother. It's that I am a father to my children. I am a teacher. I am a judge. I adjudicate crimes, if you will, within the family. I am a deliverer of justice, a punisher, a forgiver, a nurturer. All of those things. Well, dads don't do nurturing very well, but we sure as heck do try. And as a single dad for a long time, I did the nurturing thing the best I could. But these are attributes of a person. And what Omar, what you're saying is, I'm a father, a son, and a brother. No, you're talking about taking each one of those individually as a father. There's certain things I do as a father. There's certain things that I do as a son. What do I do as a son? I honor my parents. I take out the trash. I clean up the dog poop in the backyard before someone comes by to mow. You know, that sort of stuff. And as a brother, you know, having rahmanis, mercy towards your other siblings, acting appropriately with them and being a good sibling. But what you're doing when you're talking about God, the English term, the umbrella word God in English is so limiting. See, here's one thing that my non-Jewish friends in this area and I have had very long discussions about. My non-Jewish friends in the area who have taken some Bible courses at their local Baptist church or AOG church or whatever it is, and they learn a smidgen of Hebrew, and all of a sudden they're invoking these various names of God. Okay? But the problem with that is, and listen to this carefully, here's the problem with this. The problem is, let's suppose, God forbid, you have a sick child. Okay? Let's suppose you have a sick child, Twisted, and you want God to help. If you're not sure which side of God you're going to invoke, do yourself a favor, just call him God. Because the last thing you want to do is you do not want to call down a judgment side of God to help with a sick child. You understand that? Okay? So here's what I would do. I would either use the name, if you're not sure how to use them for right now, I would use either Lord or God or Hashem. Okay? Got that? I would use Lord or God or Hashem. Those are the ones I would personally suggest using. That's cool. Use Hashem. Hashem is the... Yeah. The word Hashem is actually the side of God that we are made in the image of. Okay, do you know Hebrew? Can I get a clear whiteboard? Did I do this once upon a time? Okay, can I get a clear whiteboard? I want to show you something kind of cool. Okay. The word that you're looking for, Yud, and I'll put a space, Hey, and a space, a vav, and a space, and the hey, okay? This is what people refer to as Hashem, right? This means the name. Okay? Now, how do we show that we're made in God's image? Okay? Watch this. You see these here? Remember those. Okay? And I'll show you something with it. Take those four. Let me get a new piece of paper, and I'll do it up here. Yud. Okay. Okay. Taking the Yud, which is this small letter up here, taking this, taking this and this, you have a head, shoulder, arms, and torso, hips and legs. That's the image of God. How'd you like that one? Amazing, huh? Yeah, isn't that amazing? So, if you, someone says, how are you made in the name of God, and you use the name, whoa, this is hard to do, Hashem, this name of Hashem, what is a Yud-Kei Vav-Kei? That is the nurturing sight of God that is here that we are made in the image of, okay? If you need refuah, which is health, there is the divine presence, which is a feminine attribute of God. Etc. Okay? Got that? I just went over that, Omar. I really did. I just went over that. But that was kind of cool, huh? That's the image. Okay? We are made in the image of God. Also, if you take a look at this, one more thing, then I'm going to move on. Did A. Kaplan in his book overstep what should have been taught? No. I wouldn't say he overstepped. I don't think a rabbi oversteps. The caliber of person that Rabbi Kaplan was, I would say no. But also, Omar, you've seen this, I'm sure. Right. It's hard to draw on this thing, man. Etc. You've seen this, right? Omar, oopsie, didn't finish it up. Omar, where are you? You've seen this? Okay. See this upper part right here? Yeah. This part up here? This is a part we don't understand. The human mind cannot understand this, okay? So where's the eraser part up here? I don't want to erase the whole thing. Where's the eraser part? I'll get it up here. It's one of these thingies over here. I'll find it. Anyway, okay, so let's go through here, okay? You have this part up here. Now, this part up here we don't understand, okay? This is your forehead, okay? That's your forehead. See that big wide open spot? And if you don't have any hair on the top of your head, it's a lot bigger for some of you. That's your forehead. We don't understand this. This is Keter, Chochmah, and Bina. And if you take a look at this, Omar, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Take a look at the human face. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yarmulke. Beard. Teus. Okay, got that? This and this image. Got that? There. How's that? Okay, everybody got that? Whew, that was a lot. Whew. All right, let's do this. Ooh. You know what I'm going to do next week? I'm going to start over chapter one again. All but me. Okay, I'm going to go over chapter one again. And set that off to the side. That was... thank you. Ta-da! Click. Okay. Whew. You were lost? Who was lost on that one, like everybody? Sorry. But there is an answer. The bottom line is, there is an answer to every question. Okay? There is an answer for every single question. It's just that sometimes the answer is what eludes us and we don't understand. Okay? So, in the future, who asked that? Omar. I think Omar asked that. Thank you, Omar. In the future, if you want to ask this question again and I have some time to go over it, maybe next week, I'll do it again if you'd like. Is that okay? If someone reminds me, like Omar, probably will. Okay. Whew, that was a lot. And hopefully I kind of made it a little bit clear. It's, you know, thank you. All right. Let's go into this week's Torah portion. This week's Torah portion is called Chukas. There are Chukim and Mishpatim. Rabbi, I think of our being in the image of God as have free will. The problem with that twisted, that is a very, very good statement. But think about this. Having free will does what? Having free will gives us the choice of choosing good or evil. That's what free choice is. God is only good. God does not do evil. Period. That's just not possible. God does not do evil. Okay? God doesn't do evil. God only does good. So therefore, the thought of free will isn't quite accurate. The idea of in the image of God, look in the human face. Now, it says in Genesis when God blew, in chapter 2, when God blew the soul into the nostrils of Adam, it doesn't say we pulled away. And I gave you this example last week of taking your hand flat, holding it against your nose. Not too tight, you'll get a bloody nose, and that's not a good thing. But there's no place for anything in between, number one. God is that close. Forehead to forehead, eyes to eyes, nose to nose, ears to ears, mouth to mouth. And the act of creation and recreation happens every moment of every day. Death is God removing himself from us, taking the soul with him. That's what it is. Okay? Got that? Does it say in Isaiah that Hashem creates light and darkness, good and evil? No. God doesn't create evil, Omar. And don't forget, what was said in the prophets. The prophets point us back to Torah. There's a lot of you that have come from other trainings where the prophets and writings pointed forward. Okay? God creates light and dark. No. Omar, if you go to the beginning of Genesis chapter 1, there was darkness. Darkness is Choshech. Choshech. Choshech, or Choshech, is a tangible darkness along the lines of one of the plagues. Okay, the ninth plague. Rebecca, it's a lot more than that. The darkness that it discusses in Torah, which was the darkness before God said, let there be light, and the darkness that came about with the ninth plague, just before the killing of the firstborn, was a tangible darkness. Okay, it's a tangible darkness. Okay? Principle of duality, yeah, opposites, yeah. Male and female, up and down, heaven and hell, all of that stuff. There has to be both. That's the duality I think you're talking about. Okay, let me get into this week's Torah portion before I run out of time. Okay. This week's Torah portion called Chukah. Oops, can't write over there. There are two types of commandments, rational and super rational. Those are the two types of laws. The rational laws are mishpatim. A mishpat is something like circumcise your firstborn, male. Almost got me on that one. Not to eat the hindquarters of an animal. To axe the neck of a firstborn donkey or redeem him, etc. The gates. What? Did you fix it? Really, mazel tov. Hey, the wifey got a 99.5% in her last class. I mean, 99.5%. Dang, she's smarter than I am. She's smart, somewhat. Okay, let me go back to this. Okay, there are things called rational commandments. Rational commandments as we can understand them. Okay? We understand them. God says to rest on Shabbos, observe and remember the Shabbos. That's a commandment. Know the gods before me. That's a rational commandment. Honor your mother and father. That's a rational commandment. Then we get to something called super rational commandments, which are called chukim. A chuk is a law that God said to do that we go, huh? I don't understand, and we're not supposed to. We're just supposed to do them. Here's an example of one of them. Shatness. Why can't you mix two types of material together? Because God said don't do that. You don't mix two types of material. There are Shatness laboratories that can actually check your clothing and to make sure that you don't have linen and wool put together. Yeah, you're not allowed to mix the two. That's called Shatness. This week's Torah portion, a little thing called the red heifer has popped up. The red heifer, in my opinion, is a super rational commandment. The reason is, no, it does not. It does not apply. Omar, send me an email on that, and we'll talk more. Okay, please? Send me an email on that. Okay? Okay. Email Rabbi Dov Yitzchak at gmail.com. Okay, I need to get through this before I run out of time because this is kind of an interesting one. So we have something, a super rational commandment called the red heifer. Okay? The red heifer is a cow, as in a girl bovine. It is not a calf, and it's not a mommy cow. It's a heifer. It's in between, no more than 2 years old. Can never have had a yoke around its neck, in other words, never worked, never have had a calf, and can't have, that's an interesting, oh, milk and honey. Wow, there's a lot of X's in there. I thought it was like, that's kind of an interesting name. I thought it was something out of Superman, that Oxaplix or whatever his name was. Boy, am I old. Remember that guy? That's what it looked like for a second. It says milk and honey. Okay, let me get back to this. Okay, this is kind of important. So this animal cannot have more than two red hairs. Okay? This animal is taken outside of the city, not shechted in the temple on the altar. You don't do that. It's taken outside of the city where it's shechted, it's slaughtered. Some of the blood is sprinkled in the direction of the temple. The animal is burned completely. The dung, the hide, the innards, the flesh, all of that is burnt to an ash. And that ash is used to purify people who have become ritually impure. Now, the interesting part is the person who does this work is a priest who is in a state of ritual purity, and in order for him to do this, he must become ritually impure. So the person who does this act of slaughtering the red heifer the way it's supposed to be slaughtered in this week's Torah portion becomes ritually impure. Again, a rational person would say that if you were in the state of ritual purity, that means you could participate in what you're supposed to participate, receive the parts of the animal that you're supposed to receive as a Kohen, you are going to put yourself in a lower state of impurity in order to do this red heifer thing. Makes no sense. It doesn't make any sense. Other than that's what needs to be done in order to make this stuff for somebody to become ritually pure again. That is something that is very, 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 very unusual. Okay? Question one and all, I got 15 minutes. The ordeal of the red heifer. Okay? An all red cow with no more than two black hairs. This is supposed to take a person and first and foremost make them ritually pure, right? What is the bigger thing that the red heifer does? Which I would say is even the number one thing. What did the first red heifer atone for? Anybody got a guess on that one? Is anybody awake out there? My wife makes snoring sounds behind me. Very good. Very good, Steve. Very good. This red heifer atoned, the mother, if you will, atoned for the sin of the child, which is what we parents are supposed to do. Parents are responsible, in Jewish thought, responsible for the sins of their children until the children reach the age of majority, which was 12 for girls, 13 for boys. They were no longer responsible for their sins if we taught them correctly. Not the spies. Stephen got it. It was the sin of the golden calf. Not a problem at all. The red heifer atoned for the sin of the golden calf. Okay? Got that? Let me go through this a little bit. Paraduma is the golden calf. There have been 9 golden calves throughout history. So conceptually, the red heifer could be a reminder. Not a reminder, it is an actual sprinkling of these ashes to take a ritually impure person to make them pure. There have been 9 red heifers. The 10th and final red heifer is brought by the Moshiach. That's one of the things the Moshiach does. And that's why the Southern Baptists for the last 20 years, the Southern Baptists for the last 20 years have been shipping red cows to Israel by the truckload. Yep. So breeding a red is not going to work then. It absolutely not, Francis. It can't. It's like you've heard the expression, most Christians believe that, milk and honey. Most Christians believe that. As an example, Francis, it says that if Jews were to keep, all the Jews were to keep 2 Shabbases correctly in a row, it would force the Mashiach. The problem is every Jew, over 16 million Jews in the world, were to keep 2 Shabbases, and they all wanted to do it. The only way it can be done correctly is if God gets involved. Why? Because what if a woman goes into labor and has to deliver on Shabbos? That breaks Shabbos. Even though the Pekuach Nefesh, saving the soul, you get the woman to the hospital, even if you got to drive in your car, and maybe he's got a Jewish doctor, and the doctor's got to go, and you've actually broken Shabbos, but she's going to have a baby, and if you have to, or if you have the baby before and the bris has to be on Shabbos, again, you got to have the moil, and you got all these malachas that you're doing on Shabbos. So in order for us to force it, God has to get involved. We can go ahead and try to breed all these red cows, but until God decides it's time, you could have the greatest breeding program on the planet. But if it's not time, it's not time. And like I said, the Southern Baptists have been doing that for a long time now. Okay, let's keep going with the Torah portion. Now, the qualifications of the paraduma of the red heifer. The cow must be at least 3 years old enough to bear young but never have. Its color must be completely red, even 2 hairs of another color disqualify it. Completely red. And 3, the animal is also disqualified if it once harnessed a yoke, even if it did not perform labor. Okay? Those are the qualifications. Now, although the mitzvah of the paraduma, the red heifer, is unfathomable until the time of Moshiach, in particular, it is an unsolvable mystery how it purifies an impure person while defiling a pure one. The Torah gives us a hint. One day, the palace maid's little son, while playing, dirtied the spotless floor of the palace. "Where is this imp's mother?" cried the king. "Let her come here and clean up her son's mess." Similarly, the Almighty proclaimed, "Let the mother cow atone for the impurity created by the golden calf. Therefore, only a female is acceptable as a paraduma, the red heifer, while the other sacrifices, both male and female, are eligible." Amazing. I just find this to be, I find it to be very, very remarkable. Okay, the laws of ritual cleanliness. Each of the following, this is again, this is in the Torah portion. Each of the following groups can become ritually impure under certain conditions through contact with a person or animal which is tameh. Foods, liquids, vessels, garments, and a Jewish person. Okay? Foods. Foods can become tameh only in the following two conditions, which is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful discussion I've had with other people on the subject. Gazunt. It is no longer nourished by its branch or root. It was previously touched by one of the following seven liquids: wine, bee honey, olive oil, milk, dew, blood, or water. Provided these two conditions were met and the food later touches an unclean person or animal, it becomes impure. Liquids can become impure if a liquid touches an impure person or the carcass of an animal, it becomes impure. Vessels and garments, they can become tameh if touched by an impure person. Metal or wood vessels are purified by immersion, and earthenware vessels can only be broken. And a person can become tameh if contact with, carrying, or being under the same roof of a dead person, an organ, a limb of a dead body, or with a vessel that touched a human corpse. Someone who comes in contact with a al-Khatuma, the big thing that causes ritual impurity, it lasts until the evening and he is purified by immersion in a mikveh. The person is termed Rishon Latuma, the primary carrier of this ritual impurity. Okay? Question. How are we to understand? Hang on a second. Question. Where is the bulk of the Mishnah between Chukim concerning Tameh, postpartum, etc.? Yeah. It is in here, and it's also found in Leviticus. Milk and honey, go ahead. What do they say about cooking? What about cooking food? The pots and pans come in contact with others. That's not a problem. We're talking about milk and honey. We're talking about things that come in contact with things that are ritually impure. Like if you have a metal pot that comes in contact with a dead person, for whatever reason, becomes ritually impure. And if it's a metal pot, it can become ritually pure again by scrubbing it and dunking it in a mikveh. But if it is an earthenware vessel, a clay pot comes in contact with something that's ritually impure, it must be broken and cannot be used. Now, that applies to us because of kosher laws. That doesn't apply to you guys. Bugs and broccoli, yum, yum. Yeah, it must be broken if it's earthenware. Yes. Francis, I'll get to your question in a minute. Okay? Wow. I'll do a little bit more, then I'll give Oki a chance to put up the video. Miriam's passing and the disappearance of the well of Miriam. In this Torah portion, Miriam dies. And what was Miriam's, what did she bring for us? What did she do for us? Because of her merit, we had fresh water to drink. In this Torah portion is one of the most inexplicable parts of Torah that happen. In this part, God tells Moses to speak to a rock, and water will issue forth. Moses, because his sister had died, and for whatever other reasons, spoke to the wrong rock, got mad, and hit the rock, and the rock gave forth water. And God said, because you hit it instead of talk to it, you can't go into the land. And this is something that really makes a lot of people that I've talked to a little bit crazy. The guy hit the rock instead of speaking to it, and because of that, he can't go into the land. It's important to understand that tzaddikim, righteous people, are held to a much narrower set of rules than everybody else. In other words, when God said do this, it was black or white, comply or not comply. It's much higher standards. Okay, contact with dead people, animals, and their bones make people impure. So does that mean that taking the donated parts of a dead person's heart makes a person impure? No, not at all, Rebecca. Because, Rebecca, think about it. A Jew can take a heart valve from a pig and accept that as a replacement, and it's perfectly kosher. 1 minute. Choosing higher standards. Okay. Wow, I didn't know that. Yeah, yeah. So I asked that same question. Someone says, well, man, I'm a rabbi. I got a valve replacement. It was from a pig's heart because it's closer to a human heart. I said, it's not a problem. You're not eating a pig valve. Ew. Okay. Wow, that was a whole bunch. Yeah, you're not consuming it. Okay, I'm done. I would very much love to see everybody and more in here next week. Please read this week's Torah portion, and if you have a question, I'll be more than happy to start next week's class with any answers. This is a very difficult Torah portion. And in about 3 or 4 seconds, Oki, if you could hit it, Luke, I'll be around here for a couple of minutes, then I'm out of here. Thank you, one and all, and I will see you next week. Thanks for coming in, and enjoy the music.